Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What sparked the Mexican Revolution and what long-term impact did it have on Mexico's political systems, social justice, culture, and international relations? A 1910 uprising led to the end of more than 30 years of control by President Porfirio Diaz the following year, but fighting continued sporadically for the rest of the decade as revolutionary leaders, including Emiliano Zapata and Pancho Villa, continued to insist on redistribution of land and greater rights for Mexico's poor and indigenous populations. While the long-term results of 10 years of fighting failed to achieve many of the reforms revolutionaries demanded, they did lead to a new respect for the country's native people and a flowering of Mexican art, culture, and literature. Raymond Tejas is the producer, along with Ken Rabin, of a new documentary that tells the story. It's called The Storm That Swept Mexico. It's scheduled to air tomorrow night at 9 on KERA Channel 13. Ray, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
What is so amazing about this as a documentary subject is that 1910 is recent enough for there to have been not only photography, but moving footage of what was taking place. Can you talk about where you started looking for the images you wanted to use in this film?
Yes, well, we started originally looking, within the United States at the National Archives. I mean, it's a tremendous source of material. And so that's one of the places we started looking. And we sent art out years ago, almost 8-9 years ago. We sent an archivist out to Mexico City to the Fototeca and the major archives in Mexico City. We knew a lot of the material was there. So we had a pretty good sense of where those images were. And, we started out with about 300 or 400 images in the first round, and by the time we finished our film, we had a database of over 4,000 images, not to mention the hours and hours of film footage. So we, it developed as we went along. But, we basically did an international search for the images.
The other thing you have, and it's interesting that it took you almost as long to make the film as the Mexican Revolution took, but you have interviews with former Zapatistas that were over 100 at the time that you spoke with them.
We were very lucky to get them, and that happened because of a family contact. A friend of one of my uncles in Los Angeles was a labor organizer who had lived half of the year in Cuernavaca, which is the capital of Morelos, and he had actually gone down there and organized to get benefits for these veterans. There were probably 8 or 10 veterans still alive in 2000. And a few years before that, he managed to go to the state and campaign to get them veterans benefits because they weren't getting any, which was really kind of a tragedy. Mm-hmm. So through his contact, we were able to locate these folks. And in collaboration with the state of Morelos, who signed a gentleman who was in charge of veterans benefits, we were able to track them down and 6 months later go and shoot interviews with them. At this time, early on in the development of this project, we were actually collaborating with KERA. So KERA gave us a hand on that.
Mm-hmm. And you get the sense that they were remembering these things like they were yesterday. It seems like all of them were in great shape mentally, but they they were equally passionate, in the early 2000s as they must have been in the early part of the 20th century.
Yes. Well, the thing is, this was the major event of their life, of each one of them. It was burned into their memory. These men, when they joined the revolution, which was probably in 1915 or 1916, in the later part. They were probably, 12 or 13 years of age, but this is something that they'd never experienced anything like it again in their lives, and I'm sure they told the story quite a few times. So they were well rehearsed by the time we got them.
Well, let's go back, Ray, and talk about the leader whose reign sort of tipped the whole thing off. You have Porfirio Diaz, elected in 1876. Stayed for decades, and over that time, many people started to feel like he essentially gave Mexico away to foreign investors. Can you talk about the kinds of deals that he was making?
Well, you have to understand that when he came in, when he was elected, the country was really, the infrastructure was in shambles.
Yeah.
So he depicted it as a bad guy, but you know he did he there were some really good things that he did. He just stuck around a little bit too long. But what happened is that the infrastructure was in disarray. So, for example, he invited the United States and England and Germany to come in and help rebuild the infrastructure. So, for example, the railroads got built with the assistance of the Americans. The mining and the petroleum industry were developed with the Americans and the Brits. The problem was that, you know, at one point, and one of our scholars, Ed Haley, you know, mentions that that during the Porfiriato, the investments of the United States in Mexico, in terms of dollars, was greater than the investments of Mexico, the Mexicans in Mexico. So the whole thing was kind of top heavy.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it was kind of a manifest destiny at its worst. And what happened is that the United States, I think, started to exert a little bit too much influence on politics, and Porfirio Diaz and some of the Mexican presidents that followed, you know, had to deal with that. And I think with Porfirio Diaz, it got totally out of control, and he had a very delicate alliance between the United States and Mexico, and that he had a tightrope he had to walk, and after a while he just, it fell apart.
And during this time, Diaz also sort of allowed power and wealth to rest with a very small subset of the population, and the hacienda system was very strong, where you had a few really wealthy, essentially plantation owners, and then a lot of campesinos who made pennies a day.
Yes, and not only that, but you also had a middle class that really, really had no place to go. I mean, you had a middle class who was educated and was really, really kind of kept out of the inner circle. So there was a great dissatisfaction even among the middle class. And you have to realize that the middle class, the ranchers, businessmen, those folks were the ones that initially rose up against Porfirio Diaz.
Mm-hmm. And the leader that sort of initially brought this all together was a guy named Madero. Can you tell us about him?
Yeah, well, Francisco Madero was came from the elite, actually, as did a number of presidents that followed him. He was an hacendado. His family was involved in mining. They had lots of money, but he was, you know, he wrote a couple of important documents that basically asked that, you know, Porfirio Diaz no longer be reelected. That 30 years is enough.
Mm-hmm.
And so he sparked a revolt, much to the surprise of many folks. I don't think that he was well liked. I don't think the people were behind him and actually really thought that he could be a successful president of Mexico. But he was the right guy at the right time, and the revolution kind of sparked up around him. But there'd been uprisings before 1910, and the uprising in 1910 is the one that caught on in a big way.
So the other thing that, you know, Americans who aren't very familiar with Mexico may not be aware of this, but there's a sort of a big, not just geographic, but cultural divide between the North, where, of course, Pancho Villa was very active during the revolution, and the South, where you had Zapata. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, the thing is that you have to realize that there were very, very distinct, very distinct differences culturally and also in terms of what the goals were.
Mm-hmm.
Emiliano Zapata was a regionalist. He was concerned with what went on in the state of Morelos and the surrounding regions. He was concerned with getting back the lands that had belonged to his people, the people of his region. He didn't think in international terms. So that's what he was about. Villa, on the other hand, was also sort of a regionalist, but thought in bigger terms. He operated in the northern states of Chihuahua, Sonora, Durango, but he had a bigger sense of the world and Mexico's relationship. He also understood very, very well Mexico's relationship to the United States, And Villa was supported by the U.S. for most of the revolution up till the very end, when they kind of switched their support to Carranza. And that's something that I think is little known. But he knew how to play both sides very, very well. On the other hand, you know, the revolution basically split and became a civil war. And you had Zapata and Villa as the true revolutionaries fighting against what were known as the constitutionalists. And these were basically folks from the wealthy families, and wanted to change things, but not too much. Let's not shift this paradigm that has existed for a long time and worked for us. Let's not change it too much. Emiliano Zapata and Villa, on the other hand, were really interested in turning things on their heads.
My guest is filmmaker Raymond Thayes. His new documentary, produced along with Ken Rabin, is called The Storm That Swept Mexico. It's airing nationally on PBS stations, and you can see it on KERA Channel 13 television tomorrow night at 9. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Our break right now has a purpose. We want to update you on the challenge grant from Dallas Attorney Robert Verdon, who has promised $1,500 if we can receive 100 calls of support from Think listeners by the end of this hour. The way to do that is to go to kera.org and make a contribution, or to go to 1-888-694-6931 and do it on the phone. Jeff Whittington is in now. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. I want to thank Kristen Lee in Dallas, Ryden M. Anderson in Dallas. Also, thanks to Harrison Ulrich, perhaps. Sorry, Harrison. In Plano, Barbara and Ray Anderson in Dallas, Peggy Little in Waxahachie, Alyssa Valdez in Richardson, Edward Chen in Plano, and Chris DeRose in Flower Mound. Every one of these folks has made a contribution to KERA during the Think Show today, and I just really appreciate it.
So very grateful. We wish that we could shake each of your hands individually and thank you. Of course, we can't do that, but we hope that the thanks over the air will suffice. We are down. We have 39 contributions of support left to go before we can accept this challenge grant. That's close enough that we can make it, but it's not a guarantee. It's not a shoe-in. So if you're thinking of making a contribution, doing it now will really help. And it will also help those people. There's a small subset of you that loves to help with the challenge grant when we are down to like 15 or fewer. And so if the rest of you could call right now to get us between 39 and 15, that would be really helpful. Thanks so much to Matt Panzera in Dallas, Loritz and Mary Grace Michaels in Aledo, Jennifer Callahan in Fort Worth, J.P. Hellner in Haltom City, Mary Macedonsky in Fort Worth, Julio Palacios in Louisville, Jarvis Walker in Louisville, and Tina and Robert Strickland in Mansfield.
The number to call to join these fine folks and support the station is 888-694-6931. You can go online to kera.org and make your contribution there, too. It's really crucial we hear from you this hour because Robert Verdon, a Dallas attorney and friend of KERA, has offered a $1,500 at-risk, this is at-risk, challenge grant to KERA, but only if Think listeners will make 100 contributions between noon and 2 today. We have heard from 61 of you. Thank you so much to each and every one of you, but we still need 39 contributions, or if we don't get those 39 contributions by 2 o'clock, we're going to have to turn down the $1,500.
Your contribution can be in any amount that you choose, but we would love to hear from you now at kera.org or at 1-888-694-6931. You can make a contribution of $120 and receive a copy of Packing for Mars, the book we were talking about last hour with Mary Roach. We still have copies of most of the books we've talked about during this fundraising campaign, so if you heard about one that you're still interested in, by all means, check it out online or ask the folks on the phone. They can help you with this.
888-694-6931 is the number to call, or go online to kera.org and make your contribution. Again, this is the last day to enter that iPad 2 drawing, the last of the drawings. You don't have to make a contribution, but we hope you will at kera.org or 1-888-694-6931.
Funding for Think comes from SMU summer youth programs. Camps in Legos, writing, art, reading, math, and science held at SMU in Plano and on the main campus, Dallas. Learn more at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Raymond Thais. He's producer of the new documentary, The Storm That Swept Mexico. You can watch it on television tomorrow night at 9 on KERA Channel 13 Television. If you'd like to join the conversation, we'd love to hear from you. You can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. You alluded to this earlier, but I want to talk a little bit more about it, Ray. How did Zapata and Villa break from Madero and that side at the time that the Mexican Revolution essentially became a civil war?
Well, actually, you know, Madero pushed aside Villa very early on because he had gone against the orders at the Battle of Juarez. So what happened is that Villa was pushed aside very early on by Madero, and I think with that, Madero basically wanted, you know, to control, and things, you know, made him go his way, and he couldn't really control Zapata or Villa, and so you know, things got sour pretty fast.
And that was because Villa had gone into Juarez even when Madero said, "Don't do
yeah.
it." Mm-hmm.
Basically, yeah, he and General Orozco had gone to Juarez, and there and Madero received warnings from diplomats that you better be careful because some of those bullets may go flying over to the other side and hit some people in El Paso. Actually, people were sitting on railroad cars and using them as bleachers to watch the action. So they were afraid that that somehow, you know, if Americans got injured or were shot in the crossfire, that it would go badly for Mexico. So Madero pulled back, and Villa and General Orozco did not. And so but they won the battle, but Madero didn't get over it. On the other hand, that, you know, Zapata very early on realized that Madero was not going to implement agrarian reforms. So Zapata really broke with him pretty early on.
What kind of relationship did Villa and Zapata have to one another throughout all this?
Well, I think they had a mutual respect for each other. And Zapata was very cynical and, you know, very leery of the leadership in Mexico City, while Villa was much more of a player. And so I think that what happened is that Villa reached out to Zapata and tried to draw him in. But, you know, they were both regionalists. They both, you know, wanted improvements for people from their area, but they both detested Mexico City and that old, you know, that leadership in Mexico City, and they really didn't see that the new change in leadership was that different. So, you know, they're very, very leery of the folks in Mexico City.
You know, I'm from El Paso, and Pancho Villa remains a very
right.
much larger than life figure there. His pictures up in restaurants and things like that. And he was someone who always embraced the spotlight when he could get it.
Oh, he did, absolutely. You know, he would never want to miss an opportunity to get his picture taken. You know, he loved being a celebrity. And at one point, you know, he invited the Mutual Film Company, which was a production company out of Hollywood, to film some of his battles. And we actually have some footage in the film from the Mutual Film Company.
Would he stage things for them specifically, or he just said sort of come along and catch what you can?
I think he said come along, catch some. But there were some battles, I think, that were staged. And you know, I think that he was, you know, understood the media very, very well. And he was very conscious of what was going on. So I think some battles were actually staged to a certain extent. And if you look at the footage, there's the people who, you know, who really know the material can actually pick out which were the battles that were staged, because they say, well, you know, that white smoke that's coming from those guns really wouldn't come from a real gun. So it's that kind of thing. And you can see that in a few of the shots.
All right. We should talk about the relationship between the U.S. and Mexico during these years. William Howard Taft was elected in 1908, but didn't really bother to understand on a really deep level U.S. policy toward Mexico, which invested his ambassador to Mexico, Henry Lane Wilson, with a huge amount of power.
He did. Henry Lane Wilson really used that power. You know, he was a very sharp guy, but I think he kind of overreached. He felt that he could tell Mexico what to do, and Taft did not pay attention. And then when Woodrow Wilson came in, he basically clipped Henry Lane Wilson's wings and pulled him back, because in the end, I think what Henry Lane Wilson was doing was not really in the best interests of the United States. I mean, Henry Lane Wilson was a key player in the assassination of Madero, and supported General Huerta, who was not well liked. I mean, the United States did not like him. He was a really a kind of an evil guy, and
for the Mexicans as well. Am I correct about
that? Yeah, I mean, he was not very popular in Mexico, but he was a very shrewd, powerful, and manipulative, very smart man who, to a certain extent, manipulated Madero and manipulated his way into power. But he was not trusted by Washington. And, you know, I think Washington ultimately wanted to get rid of him.
1-800-933-5372 is the telephone number if you'd like to join our conversation. Let's go on the phones now to Dee in Dallas. Hi, Dee.
Hi. I just wanted to ask the speaker how much he thought that Villa and Zapata were maybe acting and speaking on behalf, not just for the peasantry, but for the indigenous, the natives of the area.
Well, you know, I think that Emiliano Zapata was speaking more for the indigenous folks than Villa, because he came from that land of Morelos, which was his roots went back to the times of the indigenous folks, to the pre-Columbian time. So I think that if anybody understood the indigenous folks, it was Emiliano Zapata. I mean, his family went back their generations, hundreds of years. And the deeds that, you know, he allegedly carried in a tin box, you know, were deeds to land that were actually recognized by the Spanish crown when they took over those lands. But those were lands that had been in the hands of indigenous people, you know, for centuries before. So I think Emiliano Zapata really, really, you know, was closely tied to the indigenous folks. So Villa, on the other hand, was, you know, of the people, but in Chihuahua, there weren't those indigenous ties. I mean, Chihuahua was in this rough and tumble area where they had been fighting the Apache Indians, you know, for 100 years. You know, so it was a different relationship.
And in Mexico in the late 19th and early 20th century, there was just a huge amount of, I guess you have to call it out-and-out racism, a huge divide between indigenous people and those with European roots.
Yeah, well, the thing is that there was a divide between the elites and the indigenous people. They basically looked down on them. They basically said, well, you know, the problems we have in Mexico really have a lot to do with these poor people, these illiterate people, these indigenous people. But, you know, ironically, most Mexicans are mestizos. I mean, you know, 90%.
They have both heritages.
You know, and so, you know, it's a mix. So, you know, it was kind of ironic. And in the case of people like Huerta, there was, I think, a great deal of self-hatred. Huerta's mother was a Huichol Indian, and his father was a mestizo. So, you know, it's a very complicated situation. But the elites were aligned, really, you know, much more with Europe. For lots of reasons, culturally, historically, and economically.
So was it directly after Huerta's assassination that you had Venustiano Carranza become president?
Shortly after, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Carranza was one of these guys who was really, you know, interested in furthering his career more than the, you know, furthering the benefit of, you know, things. He was more interested in his career and actually reaching out to Europe than taking care of the poor people in Mexico. I mean, he was among those people who were really had his own self-interest in mind there.
Yeah, he made a lot of promises but didn't do a lot to fulfill them.
Exactly, exactly.
You know, it's so fascinating that this story takes place so close to the United States, and yet do you find that a lot of Americans really don't know much about the Mexican Revolution?
Well, I mean, they don't. I mean, I think that, you know, we don't know a lot about our own history. And in this case, you know, this is our history. And, you know, we're looking at, you know, developing curriculum materials right now for this film. And actually, we have three modules that are coming out that'll be used for high school students. And we realized that, you know, world history, I think, in most states is taught in the 10th grade, and you get a semester or so or two.
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere in there, maybe you'll get a little bit of Mexican history, but that just has to do with the way that history is taught.
Yeah, it's hard when you start with the Fertile Crescent to get to the Mexican Revolution
exactly,
by the end of the semester.
Exactly. And, you know, I also teach at UC Berkeley, and, you know, and here's one of the top universities, and I get students who have very little idea of what's going on in the U.S. And Europe and Latin America. You know, you can go through UC Berkeley and take and get out after and having taken one history class. So it's kind of it's no surprise that we don't know a whole lot about what happened in Mexico, because I don't think history is important these days in high school or college education. So I happen to think the history is really important, and that's why I made this film.
How was the revolution taught in Mexico to school children?
Well, the thing about it is that I actually, the response has been to this film is, boy, I wish I had seen your film. And these Mexicans, people who grew up in Mexico, I wish I had seen this film, a number of years ago. You would have saved me two semesters of history. And this is at the university level. And so I think that people have some idea of what happened, but, I think that it's interpreted based on who's in power. And the reason I say this is, for example, in the PRI, the revolutionary party that that's been around, was around for nearly 80 years, had a vested interest in portraying the revolutionaries as heroes, and the party that's in power now, the PAN, the PAN, who has been in power with this president and the previous president, they really have really pulled back. And actually, they're celebrating, this last year, they celebrated the bicentennial of the of their independence and the centenary of the revolution. And you would think that there hadn't been a revolution. They've really played it down because it was not in their interest to celebrate the revolution and the revolutionaries because they were the enemy. So, it all depends on, who's in power in Mexico as to how they celebrate or how you look at history.
We'll talk more about the storm that swept Mexico with its producer, Ray Theus. He produced the film along with Ken Rabin. It will air tomorrow night, at 9 o'clock on KERA Channel 13 and on PBS stations around the country on different days. If you'd like to join our conversation or ask a question of Ray, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. My colleague and friend Jeff Whittington has joined us now in the studio. Welcome back, Jeff.
Hey, thanks, Chris. Thanks so much to you for tuning in, for listening today, for participating in the show, and for participating in our spring membership campaign. We are having a great day here at KERA, thanks to so many people who've come on board as supporters and members and contributors. We've had several challenges. We've met those challenges. We have one in play right now. Robert Verdin, a Dallas attorney and friend of KERA, has presented a $1,500 challenge grant for Think listeners, that's you, to make a contribution. And he'll give us the $1,500. And this is in addition to his regular contribution as a friend of KERA, by the way. He'll give us this very generous $1,500 contribution if and only if we hear from 100 of you. Well, Chris, the great news is we have 25 contributions left to go to make this goal, but don't expect that somebody else is going to do it. We really do need you to participate right now at 888-694-6931 or on the web at kera.org.
Your contribution helps to pay for conversations like this one, like the ones that you hear us have day in and day out on this program, and for all the other programming that you hear on this station. You hear Morning Edition, you hear All Things Considered, the Diane Reams Show, Fresh Air. On Fridays, you hear Anything You Ever Wanted to Know with Jeff Whittington. And plus, we know how much you love all the shows that we have on the weekend. That all happens because we have the money to pay for it. It costs money to produce these programs locally. It costs money to essentially buy a subscription for the station from other markets. And your money helps to pay for this. We really appreciate your support now at kera.org or at 1-888-694-6931.
Just 25 contributions left to go by 2 o'clock to make this challenge. KERA will receive an additional $1,500 from Robert Verdon, a Dallas attorney and friend of the station. But we have to hear from 25 more of you for a total of 100 contributions by 2 o'clock. So please go right now to KERA.org and make your contribution, or please call 888-694-6931 because it's really important we meet this one. I mean, $1,500 is a lot for the station, and we use it as wisely and as carefully and as frugally as possible. But if we don't make this challenge, that's $1,500 we'll have to raise, you know, during the drive, and it'll take more time. It's so efficient when you respond to these challenges because it helps us get that much farther, that much quicker.
Maybe the time has come in your life and in your sort of financial life that you are ready and able to become a friend of KERA. Essentially what that means is any contribution over $1,500 a year, we have a special sort of category we call the Friends of KERA. Maybe for you, you finally decided after years of listening that you can make a contribution of $10 a month. Whatever level works for you, we want to be able to work with you. We want to bring you this programming, and we are very, very grateful that you decided to take action by going online to KERA.org or by calling 1-888-694-6931. Need 25 additional calls by 2 o'clock today in order to receive this $1,500 challenge grant from Dallas attorney Robert Verdon.
Your online contribution counts toward this goal as well. You can do that at KERA.org. Down to 22 remaining in the challenge period. And again, it ends in 20 minutes from right now. So we have to do this one call at a time. And it's really your call, your online contribution that will make this work. You actually have the power. You have the power to determine whether or not we're going to make this challenge. And I think that if you will call right now, 888-694-6931, and I know if you will go online to KERA.org right now and make your contribution, that will make it.
Just imagine if we were to miss by one, wouldn't you say to yourself, oh, well, if I'd known it was just going to be one call, then I would have made the call or I would have gone online. Well, it could be one call. And your one call might, in fact, be the one that puts us over the edge, or your online contribution may be the one. So we'd love to hear from you now online at KERA.org, where you can check out ways to pay and thank you gifts. You can also go online to on the phone line to 1-888-694-6931. Contributions count toward this challenge grant wherever they come in, but we do need to have them by 2 o'clock in order to help us make the goal for the challenge grant. We'd love to hear from you now, and we'll be back in just a minute with Ray Tejas. Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's summer youth programs. Camps in Legos, writing, art, reading, math, and science held at SMU in Plano and on the main campus, Dallas. Learn more at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is film producer Raymond Tejas, who, along with Ken Rabin, produced The Storm That Swept Mexico, a documentary that will air tomorrow night at 9 on KERA Channel 13. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. You know, it's funny, Ray, having this conversation and trying to sum up the film in 2 hours makes me respect even more the fact that you were able to sum up the entire Mexican Revolution and its legacy in 2 hours. We just have an hour here, so I'll skip forward a little bit. But
sure.
I do want to talk about Pancho Villa's famous attack on Columbus, Mexico. You mentioned to us earlier that Carranza was not a popular president with revolutionaries. And essentially, Villa was mad that the United States had supported him.
Exactly. He was mad that the United States had supported him. And apparently, he'd worked out an arrangement to get out of the country safely to Cuba. He had brokered that arrangement, and then Carranza broke his promise. At the same time, that you know there were a number of things, and some of these we couldn't really get into the film. But Villa was very pissed off at the way that Mexicans were being treated along the border, mm-hmm. along the Arizona and Texas border. There were some atrocities there, so I think he basically blew up there and raided Columbus. But he ended up losing. I mean, I think there were, you know, 17 Americans that were killed, which was, you know, tragedy. But he lost 100 of his men. Hmm. So it was, you know, he was an explosive person, and I think he blew up and took it out on a poor little town of Columbus.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. This time up, we have Jim on the line in McKinney. Hey, Jim.
Hey, how you doing?
Great, thanks.
Just wanted to agree with you. You know, Texas, our commitment to history is kind of belied by the fact that, you know, most of our history teachers are football coaches, so you know how important that is to us. But the question I have is this, is it's known that Zapata and Villa were both Freemasons, and we know that Freemasonry had some role in the American Revolution. What role did Freemasonry play in the Mexican Revolution? Was it a commitment to the ideals of equality and brotherhood, or just a way for men to keep each other's secrets?
I don't know, because we didn't really go into the Freemasonry, and I heard about it. I knew something about it, but we really didn't get into it. So I really, I'm not a historian. I wish I knew more, but I really don't. I really can't answer that question.
So I'm going to fast forward horribly here, but so you have a series of sort of puppet presidents up through 1934. In Mexico, after the fighting has stopped, but when there is still a lot of unrest in the country. And then you have a guy elected, former governor of Michoacán, and he sort of changed the way the government worked.
Right. Lázaro Cárdenas is one of the most beloved, if not the most beloved, president of Mexico. He instituted, some of the changes that had been promised by the revolution, and among them was agrarian reform. And he also, stood up against the United States and Great Britain when he nationalized the petroleum industry. So that was a big deal. It returned, a certain amount of pride to the Mexican people. He was really quite a guy. Unfortunately, that after that 6-year period where he was president, Mexico didn't really carry on forward with those reforms.
It is pretty amazing, though, during the time that he was president, that you had ordinary people sort of chipping in to help the government pay off the foreign interests in the oil industry.
It was amazing, especially amazing in light of the fact that this was in the midst of the Depression. And, the Depression had affected Mexico as much as it had depicted our country. And but basically, really, folks really believed in, in the maintenance of their sovereignty, and really got behind the president with this. It wasn't really a challenge. They didn't see it as a challenge to the United States. They basically saw it as getting back what really rightfully belonged to Mexico, and part of it was national pride.
Cárdenas also deeply opposed the Nazis, and unlike a lot of other countries, including the United States, really opened Mexico to refugees from Europe.
Yes, and in this case, there were, I believe, over 30,000 refugees from Austria and Germany, Jewish refugees who came into Mexico, and among them was one of our historians, one of our major storytellers, a guy named Friedrich Katz.
That's an amazing story. It's an amazing moment in the film when he reveals this.
Oh yes, here he is, as the detached historian who tells you the story of Villa and the secret war in Mexico, which is the name of his book, where there was all these intrigues going on between Mexico and Germany, and then he reveals that he was one of these, his family was one of the people who was actually saved, along with I think a boatload of other Jews from Austria, by Cárdenas. Cárdenas gave him refuge in Mexico, and nobody else did. And Cárdenas, gave refuge to folks from, all over Europe, from the Republicans who were, who were fighting Franco in Spain. And therefore, Lázaro Cárdenas made friends, with a lot of refugees. And Friedrich Katz, it's interesting. He just passed away just a few months ago. We were very fortunate to get the interview with him. But he was, beloved by Mexico, and he loved Mexico. And although he spent the last 30 years of his life in the U.S. in Chicago, where he developed a major Institute of Mexican Studies at the University of Chicago. He's a, he's quite a guy, but he was only one of thousands.
So after Cárdenas, the social reforms in Mexico really, pardon the expression here, sort of went south. But
They certainly did.
Yeah, but there was still this embrace of arts and culture, and particularly indigenous contributions to those things. Why? How do you explain that disconnect? You would think that both would sort of happen simultaneously.
I'm not sure what you mean by the disconnect.
Well, the fact that a lot of the reforms went away, but there was still a greater pride than there had been in the past in art and culture that originated in Mexico.
Right. Well, I think the muralist movement, for example, was triggered by the revolution. That energy that was unleashed. The artists were reflecting a new reality, and I think art is one of those things that you don't stop. You know, art and literature. That despite whatever may be happening in government, once you kind of kick off those forces, they keep on going. And the other thing is there was a lot of interest internationally in Mexico. You had American writers and artists going to Mexico to kind of figure out what was going on. Sergei Eisenstein, the Russian filmmaker, went to Mexico to film there. So Mexico became a big focus in terms of the arts and literature, and also trying to understand what's going on in Mexico. What is this revolution all about? So that kept on going, for years and years, despite the fact that the government sort of went backwards, it retrenched. Now, what they were doing to a large extent, these artists, was celebrating, the diversity in Mexico and also celebrating the indigenous culture, which had never, never been taken into account in the arts even. And so once they set this loose, then there became a great source. The indigenous people became a great source of pride to Mexico, with recognition that they did have indigenous people, and the indigenous people saw themselves reflected in the arts. So that had never happened before.
So, I mean, at the end of the day, is the revolution a failure politically and a success culturally? Is it? Can you not put it in those boxes?
I think you can. I think you can. I think you articulated it very well. I think that it was a success culturally, the art in terms of the arts, but also it was a success in terms of actually giving back to Mexico its sense of pride. Mexicans are very nationalistic, and I think they got a sense back of who they really are, and some recognition in the world, and that was a good thing. But in terms of social change, I don't think a whole lot happened, and that's my interpretation based on what we learned developing this. But Mexico, especially with Salinas de Gortari a number of years ago, started going in another direction very fast. They're actually now the lands that had been returned to the indigenous people, and some of the natural resources are beginning to be sold off again. So the country's going backwards, I think. And now it's a mess. The mess in Mexico I can't explain, but Mexico's going through some rough times again.
Raymond Theis is producer, along with Ken Rabin, of The Storm That Swept Mexico. The documentary will air on KERA Channel 13 tomorrow night at 9 o'clock. Ray, it's been such a pleasure. I was happy to be able to show this film to my kids, and I really appreciate you making the time for us.
And thank you so much. I had a wonderful chat.
Thank you very much. Thanks to all of you who are listening this hour. Thanks to all of you who have called and become members or renewed your memberships or made additional gifts. We have 11 contributions left to come in order to claim this challenge of $1,500 promised by Robert Verdon, a Dallas attorney, if we can get 100 contributions during the 2 hours of Think Today. We have 11 left to go. Please, if you've been waiting to get down to the last few, your call now will make a difference. We have lost them before with just a few to go. Now we're down to 10. As the calls come in, we get closer and closer to being able to accept not only your gift, but that additional $1,500 challenge grant from Robert Verdon. The place to get in touch with us is to go online at kera.org, or you can choose to make your contribution over the phone at 1-888-694-6931. Jeff Whittington is back in the studio. Hello, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. We've heard from a lot of folks helping us get there. Hopefully we're going to make it. Robert Waller in Bedford. Thank you, Robert. Thanks to Melissa Speed in Oakwood, Virginia. Joe and Sylvia Pendleton in Granbury. David Martinez in Lancaster. We also heard from and want to thank Stuart Cheney in Fort Worth. Hello, Stuart. Kristen Sanford in Coppell, Jeannie Torres in Dallas, and Stephen and Diana Klein in Dallas.
Thank you, Dhananjay Chaturvedi in Dallas, Dirk Schulte in Prairieville, Louisiana, Moody and Freddie Alexander in Dallas, Jonathan Mark in Bedford, Fred and Deb Holland in Dallas, Gail Reese in Tyler, Daniel and Carrie Zagota in Allen, and Mac Hopkin in Frisco. Thank you all of you so very much.
888-694-6931. That's the toll-free number. It's 1-888-694-6931. Or go to KERA.org on your smartphone or on your computer and click on the support banner and make your safe and secure, very affordable and efficient contribution there. Please do it right now because Robert Verdon, a friend of KERA and a Dallas attorney, has presented the station with a $1,500 challenge grant. But we must hear from 10 more listeners with contributions. The total was 100. We started looking for 100 contributions at noon for the two-hour show, and we're down to just needing 10. Don't think that it's just going to happen. If you haven't made your contribution yet during the drive, or if you're considering making a small or substantial additional gift, do that right now so that we can wrap this challenge up and accept an additional $1,500.
Keep in mind that today is the final day to enter the iPad 2 drawing, so you will also, when you make your contribution between now and 1 o'clock, get entered into that, now and 2 o'clock, I should say, or for the rest of the day. Want to thank Leora Hughes in Wichita Falls. They went online to KERA.org, or perhaps Leora called 1-888-694-6931, and I'm guessing Leora is a she and not a they. Thanks also to Natasha and Igor in Coppell, Eric and Reese Smith in Arlington, Trudy Jackson in Murphy. Really appreciate it.
888-694-6931, online at KERA.org. Thanks to Lori Torrance in Arlington as well. We are looking now just for 9 more contributions on the web or on the phone. We have... I'm looking at that. We have about 3 minutes to do it. So
I'm freaking out.
Chris is squinching over
there.
Don't
do this because I'm squinching. Don't do this to relieve my nerves. Do it because you love the station and because you know how far an additional $1,500 in addition to your gift can go to pay for the programs that you
love. Yeah, and that $1,500, it's going to take time to make it up somewhere else in this drive. So think about that. Think about the fact that by making your contribution right now at whatever level, and helping us meet this challenge, you're allowing Robert Verdon to chop a chunk of the drive off by making this additional $1,500 contribution to KERA. That's how it works when we get this kind of a challenge, and that's what we want to do today. But we've got to hear from you right now at KERA.org or on the phone at 888-694-6931.
If you would like to make a contribution of $350, we have the Ken Burns ultimate pack of DVDs. You can get the entire box set of the war, of the Civil War, and of the war, and of baseball, and several other choices as well. And you can find about that exactly online. I can't call it to mind right this moment, but you can see it online at KERA.org or call 1-888-694-6931. The folks on the phone can tell you. We have an update, Jeff.
Yes, just needing 4 more contributions here in the last couple of minutes. It's that Ken Burns Super Pack's a $350 contribution.
Thank you very much.
When you join, and you do get the national parks, the Civil War,
the national parks,
the war, which is about World War II, and baseball. It's 61 hours of DVD goodness from Ken Burns when you make that $350 contribution, and you'll help us make this challenge. I want to thank Robert Verdon, Dallas attorney and friend of KERA, for offering $1,500 challenge. I would love to be able to tell you that we made it, but we are 4 contributions away from making this.
So, 2 contributions away.
It's 2 contributions away. So please be one of those folks, 888-694-6931, or online at KERA.org. It's your source for NPR News, KERA, and it's 90.1 KERA. Dallas, Fort Worth, Denton.
Your contribution matters, and you can hear how we use it when you turn on the radio every day. Right now, the radio that you're hearing, if you've never been a member, is because of someone else's contribution before you. Someone said, yes, this is important. I think public radio belongs not only, you know, streaming through my radio in my car or in my kitchen or at my office, but it should be a resource for all of North Texas. Your contribution serves not only you, but the entire community. And if you listen on the podcast, and it is
you're listening in a faraway place at a strange time, all of the contribution places still work. You can still go online to KERA.org. You can still call 1-888-694-6931 and make your contribution.
Hey, Chris, we made the challenge.
Hooray. Thank you so much.
Thanks to
Don't
everybody.
Don't hang up, though, if you're online right
no,
now.
Keep going on and making your contribution so that you can get out of the way because you decided to do it. Thank you so much for all of your contributions on the phone or at KERA.org. And thanks especially to Robert Verdon, a Dallas attorney and friend of KERA, for his $1,500 challenge grant, which we made.
Thanks to all of you. You guys are great. We know we can count on you, and we really appreciate it. We'll be back tomorrow with another show and ask you to keep on getting in touch at KERA.org or at 1-888-694-6931. Have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.